Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, April 21st, 2024. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona, and we'll begin this first hour with an investigative report from the Arizona Republic. On the front page, it's entitled, A Growing Threat, Gun Threats Ratchet Up Fears. The number of gun threats per year is rising in Arizona schools, a Republic investigation shows. So is the number of guns confiscated from students. What's behind the scary statistics? This article is by L.M. Boyd and Yana Kunichoff. The subtitle of the article is Arizona's K-12 Schools and Police Face Flood of Gun Threats, Lockdowns, Weapons. The threat of gun violence is real in Arizona schools. As real as a handgun in a backpack, as tangible as components of an assault rifle in a student's pants. Police agencies have responded to thousands of calls from Arizona schools since January 1, 2019. Threats of shooting up a school, of harming teachers, of targeting a classmate. In 2022, police handled an average of 2 gun threat incidents a day, according to an Arizona Republic investigation. From 2019 to 2022, emergency calls from schools came in, on average, about 10 times a week. Most calls involved just threats, cries for attention or help. Hearsay, rumors, and social media posts prompted many calls to police. Anxiety about a potential gun attack demands that a school community approach each threat as valid until proven otherwise. But at least 96 times, weapons were found in students' possession, the Republic learned. And the danger is not going away. Some examples from the past calendar year, May 2023. In Phoenix, a Bostrom High School student brought the components of an AR-15 to campus. August 2023. In Phoenix, a preschool student at Kyrene de la Estrella Elementary School carried a loaded gun in a backpack. September 2023. In Phoenix, police found a student in possession of a handgun at Maryvale High School. January 2024. In Scottsdale, an 11-year-old boy was arrested on suspicion of bringing a loaded gun to Mountainside Middle School. February 2024. In Buckeye, a school resource officer secured a firearm from a student at Yunker High School. April 2024, in Phoenix, a student on a school bus headed to an elementary school was found with a gun. Gun threats and guns found at school have been rising since 2019, the Republic investigation found, but Arizona has been fortunate not to experience a mass casualty attack by students or on students in a K-12 school. The drumbeat of police calls to school was stunning. Almost 2,200 gun threats were logged by more than 70 departments in the 4 years the Republic surveyed. The Republic found 26 students brought guns to school in calendar year 2019, 8 in 2020, 19 in 2021, and 43 in 2022. From 1970 until June 2022, 19 shootings were reported on school campuses in Arizona, according to the Center for Homeland Defense and Security. They left 11 people dead and 10 wounded. 5 of those school shootings, incidents in which a gun was fired accidentally or intentionally, occurred from 2019 through June 2022. 2 of them involved a student firing the weapon. In November 2021, a student was shot by a classmate during a dispute in a bathroom at Cesar Chavez High School in Phoenix. In March 2022, a Kingman student accidentally shot his classmate on a school bus. Whether gun threats are legitimate or not, learning is put on pause. Law enforcement personnel spend time and resources to investigate the veracity. Fearful teachers and students in lockdown are left wondering, what if? Officer Tricia Smalley is the school resource officer assigned to Benson Unified School District, composed of elementary, middle, high, and alternative schools, about an hour southeast of Tucson. The thought of a school shooting has kept her up at night, she said. She even put her daughters through active shooter preparedness training. Every single school where there's a mass shooting, they say, we never thought it would happen here, Smalley said. I always play scenarios in my head. The age of students making gun threats in Arizona schools varied from preschool to high school. Threats came in rural areas and urban, in wealthy areas and working class. Many of them involved students with grievances with teachers or peers. Many of the students were experiencing bullying, mental health struggles, or emotional distress. And when students brought a firearm onto a school campus, they often gained access from a family member. Data on gun threats took the Republic more than 16 months to compile from police agencies. Some of the data is supposed to be supplied by schools to the federal government, but the Republic found schools failed to fill out a required form correctly, if at all. And the Arizona Department of Education does not track how often lockdowns occur. The reports obtained by the Republic from police agencies offered a glimpse into what happens at schools when gun threats are called in, who is making the threats, and what school officials hope to do to get ahead of the problem. The boy with a gun at Bostrom brought more tears, more pain than I've ever experienced in my time at Phoenix Union, said Chad Geston, who was that district superintendent at the time. While Smalley has not had to respond to a student gun threat since her SRO role began in December 2022, she has initiated classroom lockdowns when people wanted by law enforcement came near school property. I'm here on campus because, you know, I signed up to be the bullet sponge, if you will, Smalley said. I'm the one that's running toward the danger. I'm the one that's going to take the bullet. Emotional distress, bullying often in play in Arizona gun threats. Arizona police responded to 801 gun threats in K-12 schools in calendar year 2022, compared with 654 incidents in 2019, according to the Republic investigation. In 2022, Phoenix police received nearly half of the gun threats in the state. Emotional distress and bullying were core issues behind gun threats, police reports and interviews with more than a dozen behavioral and education experts show. Each incident requires a close examination for the underlying issues, they said. In May 2019, at an elementary school in Kingman, a boy in foster care showed signs of emotional distress when he lost a classroom trivia game. He threatened to set the school on fire and bring a gun to school. An officer came to the boy's house to speak with him. Ultimately, the officer filed a referral to prosecutors asking that the boy be charged with misdemeanor disorderly conduct. In January 2020, at a charter school in Prescott Valley, a student told police he kept a mental list of people he would kill, injure, or save based on who bullied him. He advised friends in a video game chat not to come to school. In September 2022, at a charter school in Casa Grande, a student said he would bring a gun to school to shoot people who didn't like him. In the case of a student threatening to physically harm someone, whether it is spoken, written, or gestured, the Arizona Department of Education encourages schools to have a threat assessment protocol and build a team to determine whether the student legitimately poses a threat of violence. Experts stress that a threat assessment should not be approached as punitive action, but with genuine care and compassion for the student. They recommend including an adult who works at the school whom the child trusts to sit in during the assessment. Mental health workers, counselors, school resource officers, and administrators should collaborate to tailor the best response for the child's needs, said Dr. Paula McCall, a Chandler-based child psychologist. When behavior escalates toward threatening, McCall advised that the child be treated with the same compassion as a student threatening suicide or self-harm. Most prevention efforts rely on the staff, parents, and students closest to the young people making gun threats. and having peers who notice when a student is acting strangely or who trust adults in the school enough to report disturbing statements is also key. At Bostrom High School, students who spoke up to school officials about one of their classmates had noticed he was walking funny and was dressed in an unusual way, wearing a puffer jacket and an orange ski mask in hot May temperatures. Officials later learned that the boy had part of a semi-automatic rifle in his pants. Bostrom is one of several schools in the Valley to install metal detection technology to boost campus safety, although officials say it's too soon to tell whether it's effective. It's a difficult time to be a kid, and many teachers believe all the social ills within a community are placed on their laps at the start of class each day, according to Marisol Garcia, a teacher and Arizona Education Association president. When you see a school that is struggling, then you know that community is struggling as well, Garcia said. Weapons easy to find, police officers more scarce. Students were caught with guns in schools at least 40 times in 2022, according to the Republic investigation. In 2019, students were caught with guns 26 times. Easy access to firearms adds to officials' fears, in addition to the shortage of police officers to serve as school resource officers. Two boys attending Cactus Middle School in Casa Grande in April 2019 were referred to prosecutors for charges of firearm possession on suspicion that they passed a gun to each other on campus. One of the boys said he was directed to grab the gun from his mom's room, according to the police report. In October 2021, a 15-year-old boy in Apache Junction was referred for a charge of gun possession after grabbing the weapon from his mom's car at a football game. The teen's mother told officers she had forgotten the gun was in the car, according to the police report. Prosecutors have limited recourse in pursuing charges against firearm owners when minors have access to weapons. Arizona does not have a child access prevention law that imposes a penalty on someone who leaves an unattended firearm accessible to an unsupervised minor. Multiple attempts to pass bills requiring safe storage for guns or background checks for private sales have failed. At the state level, members of a school safety committee convened by Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn hope to increase staffing of law enforcement officials in schools. Lawmakers were pushing for a bill that would fund those efforts. Advocates for education workers say each school should be able to determine what safety measures are appropriate based on input from students, parents, teachers, and classified employees like librarians, cafeteria workers, and janitorial staff. Arizona schools often don't comply with federal reporting. Federal law since 1994 has required schools that receive federal funding to report firearms incidents. However, most K-12 public schools in Arizona fail to accurately track how often a student was in possession of a firearm at school. Arizona has been the lowest-scoring state in the country for compliance for 3 consecutive years, according to the Gun-Free Schools Act data. Most U.S. states and territories are consistently at more than 80% compliance. In the most recent year, Arizona was under 40%. Schools are supposed to collect and report several pieces of information about firearms on campus. How often a student brought a firearm to school or was in possession of a gun on school property, the student's grade level, the weapon type, and the disciplinary action imposed. The Arizona Department of Education is prohibited by state law from collecting discipline data for students through student information systems, according to the latest Gun-Free Schools Act report. Student information systems are software used to track students' grades, attendance, achievements, and test scores. Instead, Arizona used a survey administered to superintendents to collect data for firearms incidents and associated discipline. In recent years, many Arizona public schools either have failed to submit the data or submitted it incorrectly or incompletely, making it difficult to understand whether incident rates are growing, what safety measures are working, or whether students are more at risk of gun violence. Failure to comply with reporting requirements could put Arizona at risk for a delay or termination of federal funding. Out of 2,361 schools required to submit a Gun-Free Schools Act report to the Arizona Department of Education, 37% submitted data for the 2020-2021 school year. Out of 691 local education agencies, a school district or charter school, 37.9% complied with Gun-Free Schools Act reporting. Based on incomplete Gun-Free Schools Act data, the State Education Department reported 10 occasions in which a student brought a firearm to school in the 2020-2021 school year. For the 2019-2020 school year, 21.8% of eligible schools and 17.2% of local education agencies complied. 10 students were reported to have brought a firearm to school. For the 2018-2019 school year, 69% of schools and 55% of local education agencies complied. That year, the state reported 27 students bringing a firearm to school. Private schools, some charter schools, or any schools that do not receive funding under the Every Student Succeeds Act are exempt from reporting data, rendering it impossible to have a complete picture of how often students bring guns to those schools. Aside from the incomplete data, the latest report advises that the findings should be interpreted with caution. Data for the 2020-2021 school year is skewed because of widespread in-person school closures prompted by the COVID-19 pandemic, the report said. Superintendents are responsible for gathering and submitting the data to the Arizona Department of Education, according to federal law. According to the Education Department, this data is collected via SurveyMonkey, a cloud-based survey tool that helps users create, send, and analyze surveys. Elise Minati is a school social worker in the Phoenix area who has trained districts on behavioral threat assessment and written grant proposals for school safety measures. It is really important to capture that data, so when you're applying for federal and state grants, then you're able to show the need, Minati said. The additional steps school superintendents must take to complete a SurveyMonkey form, a step educators in other states don't have to deal with, could be complicating the process, she said. I think there's a disconnect here, Minati said. Educators are doing the best they can. Republic's analysis based on police reports. Reports on gun threats in Arizona schools took the Republic more than a year to compile and analyze. Many Arizona schools fail to report gun incidents as required by law, and they are not required to track threats or make information about threats readily available. The Republic filed public records requests to all existing Arizona police departments asking for calls for service on gun threats in K-12 schools. The request sought a catalog of incidents for almost 4 years, from January 1, 2019, through the date of the records request submission in October or November 2022. It wasn't until April 4, 2024, that the Republic obtained responses from all agencies. The information the Republic gathered is incomplete. The analysis does not account for calls for service to sheriff's departments, marshals' offices, or tribal law enforcement agencies that have schools within their jurisdictions. Complicating and delaying matters, each police agency had its unique system for records management and data software. Understaffing and turnover affected some records offices. Certain data software used for computer-aided dispatch, CAD, limited the ability of users in some police departments to narrow down calls. Differing systems produced differing responses to the Republic's requests. Some police departments provided full incident reports. Most departments provided CAD call logs, created spreadsheets, or typed out summaries of incidents in an email. CAD searches did not always yield complete results. Instances reported by news outlets of police responding to a school for a firearm threat sometimes were not included in data records obtained by the Republic. Reports were not updated to include whether prosecutors opted to charge the students with what officers recommended, what discipline the school gave out, or what mental health resources a student received. The Republic's analysis also can't account for the incidents in which schools did not involve law enforcement, nor the gun threats that never went reported. Free mental health resources are available to anyone in Arizona. A statewide mental health crisis line is available at 844-534-HOPE. That's 534-4673. Another resource for 24/7 help is to dial 988, the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Teen Lifeline is for kids to call and get free, confidential, and anonymous help from trained peers at 602-248-8336 or 800-248-8336 outside of Maricopa County. And that article was entitled Gun Threats Ratchet Up Fears by L.M. Boyd and Yana Kunichoff. We're going to move on now to Valley and State News with this next article entitled What's Next for Repeal of Arizona Abortion Ban, with the subtitle Some in Legislature See No Rush to Take Action. This is by Mary Jo Pitzel, Ray Stern, and Stacey Barchinger. Abortion will be the dominant topic at the Arizona legislature for weeks to come, thanks to Wednesday's action by state lawmakers. House Republicans again rebuffed attempts to repeal a near-total abortion ban, while Democrats promised to keep trying. 3 hours later, state senators, on a bipartisan vote, started the process to reconsider a repeal bill. Back in the House, a conservative lawmaker promised Republicans will soon unveil a plan to give voters a choice on abortion laws in November. The state Supreme Court ruling that revived the 1864 law takes effect on Tuesday, but a ruling from a related court case stays enforcement for 45 days. That has led state GOP legislative leaders, as well as Democratic Attorney General Chris Mays, to argue the bill won't have any legal teeth until early June. Meanwhile, legislative developments will happen on a once-a-week basis, given the House and Senate plan to meet only on Wednesdays while negotiations on the state budget continue. How can Arizona abortion ban repeal advance in the state Senate? When the Senate returns April 24th, it could take action on Senate Bill 1734, introduced by Senator Anna Hernandez, Democrat of Phoenix. It's identical to the bill the House Democrats have been trying to get to a vote. That action, called a second read, could advance the bill to a definitive vote in the following weeks. Republican Senators Shauna Bolick of Phoenix and T.J. Shope of Coolidge joined with 14 Senate Democrats to support Hernandez's bill. Senator Ken Bennett, Republican of Prescott, voted with Bolick and Shope to oppose a motion to quash Hernandez's bill, but said he does not support the repeal. He said the pro-abortion measure likely to appear on November's ballot goes too far. Bennett added repealing the 1864 law, which would leave intact a law that bans abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy, is the best chance as pro-lifers to defeat the proposed ballot measure. Will enough House Republicans join Democrats to repeal Arizona abortion ban? In the House, Speaker Ben Toma, Republican of Glendale, has maintained an issue as heavy, as complicated, as emotionally and morally complex as abortion takes time to work out. Besides, there is no rush to address a repeal, he added. That's because any bill passed by the legislature would not take effect until 90 days after the session adjourns for the year. Adjournment does not appear to be on the near horizon. Despite those admonishments, the 29 House Democrats, as well as the one Republican who sided with them on Wednesday, said they'll keep pushing for a repeal. We'll bring it back to the floor again, House Minority Leader Lupe Contreras, Democrat of Avondale, said after Wednesday's failed attempts. This is not going away. Representative Matt Gress was the only Republican supporting a repeal vote. Democrats had expected Representative David Cook, Republican of Globe, to join with them, which could have given them the 31 votes needed to override Republican objections. But Cook said he felt the rules weren't followed and he refused to roll the speaker, meaning provide the final vote to neutralize Thoma's objections. Republicans could do a late introduction of their own bill, or the speaker can grant permission for a committee to hear a bill, Cook said, adding, if we start doing away with all the rules, then why even have them to begin with? Gress later praised the Senate for its initial support of a repeal bill and reiterated his belief that there are enough GOP votes to pass a repeal out of the House, maybe as soon as next week. Make no mistake about it, we will repeal, the Phoenix Republican said. It will happen. It's just a matter of time. The people of Arizona expect us to take action, and we will. Looming election complicates GOP reprisals aimed at pro-repeal Republicans. Gress, Bollock, and Shope are from swing districts where Democrats are working to score wins, which could potentially give the Democrats control of the legislature. GOP leaders who want to keep control of the legislature will have to weigh how hard to press renegade members to get in line with abortion policy for fear of them losing their elections. A single seat loss would evenly split the legislature, so it's in leadership's interest to help these lawmakers keep their seats. Representative Alexander Kolodin, Republican of Scottsdale, announced that tomorrow or soon after, Republicans will present a plan that he said would give voters in November choices at the ballot. That would make good on Republican plans revealed earlier this week to counter the Arizona for Abortion Access initiative to enshrine abortion rights in the state constitution. For example, a GOP strategy document suggested by lawmakers could refer up to 3 abortion measures that would dilute the dominance of the initiative, which already has gathered more than enough voter signatures to qualify for the November 5th ballot. Those referrals would have the advantage of going straight to the ballot without needing approval from Governor Katie Hobbs, a supporter of abortion rights. However, finding the votes for such plans might be difficult given a number of Republican lawmakers support the 1864 law and have applauded the Supreme Court's ruling. Hobbs, for her part, has said she would be open to calling a special legislative session to focus on the abortion issue, as long as there are the votes to pass a repeal bill. A special session would speed up the time until the bill could become law. On Wednesday, she reiterated her intent to see the law repealed. I will continue to call on the legislature to do its job and repeal this law, she said in a statement. In the meantime, I remain committed to protecting the freedoms of every single Arizonan, and I'm working to make sure women are able to access the care they need. A law from 1864 written by 27 men cannot be allowed to govern the lives of millions of Arizona women. It's time to put politics aside and do the right thing. And that article was entitled, What's Next for Repeal of Arizona Abortion Ban? And that was by Mary Jo Pitzel, Ray Stern, and Stacey Barchinger. We're approximately 30 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, April 21st, 2024. Continuing on with Valley and State News, this next article is entitled, Santa Cruz Fourth on Endangered Rivers List, with a subtitle, Threats to Water Security and Climate Change Cited. This is by Haley Evans. The Santa Cruz River is the fourth most endangered river in America, according to American Rivers 2024 rankings. The river conservation nonprofit released its annual America's Most Endangered Rivers list Tuesday to call attention to 10 of the most at-risk rivers and streams due to drought, pollution, and climate change. Nominated by the Sonoran Institute, the Santa Cruz was listed due to threats to water security and climate change. All rivers in New Mexico were ranked first on the list following a Supreme Court rollback on Clean Water Act protections. The Sackett versus EPA ruling left 96% of New Mexico's streams vulnerable to pollution, with potential downstream impacts to the Rio Grande, Gila, San Juan, and Pecos rivers, American River said. All water is connected. We cannot allow pollution anywhere without risk to the rivers we rely on for drinking water, said Tom Kieran, president and CEO of American Rivers. America's Most Endangered Rivers is a national call to action to defend the streams and rivers on which all life depends. The Colorado River and the Grand Canyon was the most endangered river last year. The Colorado has made the list several times, and American Rivers has previously highlighted other Arizona rivers, including the Gila, the Verde, and the San Pedro. Climate change, weakened regulation imperil many rivers. The American Rivers Report calls for protection and aims to raise awareness of the 10 rivers featured and conservation for all 3 million miles of rivers across the nation. The list signals severe degradation to the nation's waterways, as about 44% are too polluted for swimming or fishing, according to the EPA, and freshwater marine life is going extinct at unprecedented rates. Climate change has spurred severe floods and droughts, and new legal rulings have scaled back protections, worsening water quality, the group says. The Clean Water Act was enacted in 1948 and implemented pollution control programs to keep waterways clean. It set wastewater standards and made it illegal to release pollutants into navigable waters without a permit. In 2023, the EPA amended the definition of waters of the United States based on the Sackett versus EPA decision. It narrowed the scope of waters subject to federal jurisdiction, deeming relatively permanent or continuously flowing waterways forming geographic features qualify. The new definition also states the Clean Water Act only applies to wetlands that are difficult to distinguish from waterways. To nominate waterways threatened in some way, local groups had to prove the river's importance to people and wildlife, the severity of the threat to the river and community, and identify a decision in the next 12 months the public can influence. Santa Cruz flows with treated wastewater. The Santa Cruz has been revitalized in the last 15 years, but advocates worry climate change and water scarcity could undo years of progress. The river's perennial flows ceased in 1913 from extreme groundwater use, and seasonal flows followed in 1940. In the following decades, partially treated wastewater was discharged into the river, worsening water quality that endangered the ecosystem and the surrounding communities. In 2008, wastewater treatment facilities were updated and now provide about 35 miles of perennial flows. As water quality improved, native fish, wildlife, and vegetation have returned to the river. As Tucson relies on water supplies from the dwindling Colorado River, advocates fear less wastewater will be released into the Santa Cruz. The water is treated to a really high quality and then released into the Santa Cruz, but you need water in the first place to create the Santa Cruz, said Luke Cole, Santa Cruz River Program Director for the Sonoran Institute. That's really what the main threat is. Why advocates campaign for protection? The Sonoran Institute is campaigning for an urban national wildlife refuge designation to protect the Santa Cruz. If granted by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, this designation would provide funding for the federal government to buy parcels of land that would be protected permanently. National wildlife refuges must be within 25 miles of urban areas and help residents engage with nature and protect wildlife. The designation would allow the government to acquire more property in the future, provide open spaces for wildlife, and provide amenities within the refuge. "We're seeing people using the river again. Native fish, birds, and wildlife are coming back," Cole said. "All of this desert life needs the Santa Cruz River, and the recognition of it through this campaign is a great tool to help people refamiliarize themselves with this system and see the value in it." Beyond the potential designation, Cole hopes the Santa Cruz's place on the endangered rivers list will raise awareness about the threats to the river and encourage the public to advocate for its survival. "For me, this is really a rebirth story that deserves to be told," Cole said. "To see the recovery of the Santa Cruz River in the last 15 years is unlike anything I've ever seen before." And that article was entitled "Santa Cruz Fourth on Endangered Rivers List," and that was by Haley Evans. Our next article is entitled "Phoenix Ranks High on List of Cities Marijuana Use." This is by Abigail Beck. April 20th, more commonly referred to as 420, has just passed, bringing with it a renewed mania for marijuana. Phoenix is no exception. A new study conducted by Real Estate Witch, an online resource for all things real estate, and Leafly, a website for cannabis consumers, revealed that Phoenix has the most passion for pot in the nation. Arizona became the 13th state to legalize cannabis for recreational use in 2020 after Proposition 207, also known as the Smart and Safe Arizona Act, passed by a margin of about 20%, according to azmarijuana.com. A Real Estate Witch survey determined that 74% of Americans have a non-negative view of cannabis smokers, 62% have tried it, and four states, Florida, Idaho, Nebraska, and South Dakota, have marijuana legalization on the ballot this upcoming election cycle. What makes Phoenix the most passionate pot city? Phoenix earned a perfect score of 100 for pot passion due to the volume of marijuana-related Google searches and Leafly site visits. Also, Arizona is home to the only cannabis-infused kitchen in the United States, the study found. At Mint Cafe, customers can buy anything from weed pizza to wings to a plethora of cannabis-infused baked goods. How does Phoenix rank for cannabis consumption? Overall, Phoenix ranks 6th nationally for best weed cities, according to Real Estate Witch and Leafly. This is a jump from last year when Phoenix was ranked 13th overall. A variety of factors played into Phoenix's top 10 rating, as noted by the study. 2.7 marijuana retailers per 100,000 residents. An average rating of 4.42 out of 5 stars for marijuana retailers across the state, which is the highest rating within the top 17 best cities for cannabis consumers. Nationally, the rating is 3.59 out of 5. Phoenix ranks 4th overall for dispensary ratings. 0.6 doctors who prescribe cannabis per 100,000 residents. The average price of an ounce of high-quality cannabis costs $292.22, which is below the national average of $318, and 1 ounce of middle-quality cannabis costs $234.66. Passion for pot and the Leafly Visitor Index, as measured by search trends, received a 100 out of 100. There are 0.5 head shops or drug paraphernalia stores per every 100,000 residents. Top 15 U.S. cities for marijuana use. Listed from highest to lowest rating, according to the Real Estate Witch and Leafly study, they are Denver, Portland, Oregon, Las Vegas, Buffalo, New York, Baltimore, Phoenix, Seattle, Sacramento, California, Kansas City, Missouri, Providence, Rhode Island, Boston, San Jose, California, Hartford, Connecticut, San Francisco, Oklahoma City. Top 15 worst cities for cannabis use. Listed from lowest to highest rating according to the Real Estate Witch and Leafly study. They are Louisville, Kentucky, Dallas, Atlanta, Houston, Birmingham, Alabama, Nashville, Tennessee, Charlotte, North Carolina, Milwaukee, Memphis, Tennessee, Indianapolis, Raleigh, North Carolina, New Orleans, Salt Lake City, Miami, Pittsburgh. These municipalities either only allow marijuana for medicinal use, only allow CBD oil, have decriminalized cannabis, or have a crossover of many of these factors. And that article was entitled "Phoenix Ranks High on List of Cities Marijuana Use" by Abigail Beck. We're now going to move on to national and world news with articles from USA Today, with this first one regarding war in the Middle East entitled "Several Palestinians Killed in West Bank," with the subtitle "Gaza Has Overshadowed Violence in Territory." This is by Ali Sawafta and Nadal Al-Maghrabi. Israeli forces killed 14 Palestinians during a raid in the occupied West Bank on Saturday, while an ambulance driver was killed as he went to pick up wounded from a separate attack by violent Jewish settlers, Palestinian authorities said. Israeli forces began an extended raid in the early hours of Friday in the Nur Shams area near the flashpoint Palestinian city of Tulkarm and were still exchanging fire with armed fighters well into Saturday. Israeli military vehicles massed and bursts of gunfire were heard, while at least three drones were seen hovering above Nur Sham, an area housing refugees and their descendants from the 1948 war that accompanied the creation of the State of Israel. The Tulkarm Brigades, which groups forces from numerous Palestinian factions, said its fighters exchanged fire with Israeli forces on Saturday. The West Bank, a kidney-shaped area about 60 miles long and 31 miles wide, has been at the heart of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict since it was seized by Israel in the 1967 Middle East War. The Gaza War has overshadowed continuing violence in the territory, including regular army raids on militant groups, rampages by Jewish settlers in Palestinian villages, and street attacks by Palestinians on Israelis. Thousands of Palestinians have been arrested and hundreds killed during regular operations by the Israeli military and police since the start of the Gaza War, most members of armed groups, but also stone-throwing youths and uninvolved civilians. On Saturday, Palestinian health authorities said at least 14 Palestinians, two of whom were identified by Palestinian sources and officials as a gunman and a 16-year-old boy, were killed during the raid, one of the heaviest casualty totals in the West Bank in months. Another man was killed on Friday. The Israeli military said a number of militants were killed or arrested during the raid, and at least four soldiers were wounded in exchanges of fire. In a separate incident, the Palestinian Health Ministry said a 50-year-old ambulance driver was killed by Israeli gunfire near the village of Al-Sawiya, south of the city of Nablus, as he was making his way to transport people injured during the attack on the village. It was not immediately clear whether he was shot by settlers. There was no immediate comment from the military. Gaza strikes continue. In Gaza, where fighting has continued despite the withdrawal of most of Israel's combat forces earlier this month from southern areas, the death toll passed 34,000, Palestinian health authorities said on Saturday. Israeli strikes hit the southern city of Rafah, where over 1 million Palestinians are sheltering, as well as Al-Nusrat in central Gaza, where at least five houses were destroyed, and the Al-Jabaliya area in the north, health officials and Hamas media said. In Rafah, a strike hit a house and killed a father, daughter, and pregnant mother, Hamas and Palestinian media outlets said. Doctors at the Kuwait hospital were able to save the baby, medics said, making the baby the family's only surviving member. Five other Palestinians were killed in a separate Israeli airstrike on the city before midnight, health officials said. The Israeli military said troops were carrying out raids in central Gaza, where they were engaged in close-quarter combat with Palestinian fighters. Overall, Israeli strikes in Gaza killed 37 Palestinians and wounded 68 over the past 24 hours, Palestinian health authorities said. Rafah is the last Gaza area that Israeli ground forces have not entered in a more than six-month war aimed at eliminating the Islamist Hamas group that rules the enclave, following the Hamas attack on southern Israel on October 7th, which killed some 1,200 Israelis and foreigners. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has faced wide international opposition to the plan to attack Rafah, where the military says the last remaining organized brigades of Hamas are. And that article was entitled, Several Palestinians Killed in West Bank, and that was by Ali Sawafta and Nidal Al-Maghrabi. In national news, this article is entitled, House Passes Foreign Aid Package, with a subtitle, Senate Will Consider $95 Billion Bill on Tuesday. This is by Richard Cowan, Moira Warburton, and Patricia Zengerle. The House of Representatives on Saturday, with broad bipartisan support, passed a $95 billion legislative package providing security assistance to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan over bitter objections from Republican hardliners. The legislation now proceeds to the Democratic Majority Senate, which passed a similar measure more than 2 months ago. U.S. leaders from Democratic President Joe Biden to top Senate Republican Mitch McConnell had been urging embattled Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson to bring it up for a vote. The Senate is set to begin considering the House-passed bill on Tuesday, with some preliminary votes that afternoon. Final passage was expected sometime next week, which would clear the way for Biden to sign it into law. The bills provide $60.84 billion to address the conflict in Ukraine, including $23 billion to replenish U.S. weapons, stocks, and facilities, $26 billion for Israel, including $9.1 billion for humanitarian needs, and $8.12 billion for the Indo-Pacific, including Taiwan. It was unclear how quickly the new military funding for Ukraine will be depleted, likely causing calls for further action by Congress. Biden, who had urged Congress since last year to approve the additional aid to Ukraine, said in a statement, "It comes at a moment of grave urgency, with Israel facing unprecedented attacks from Iran and Ukraine under continued bombardment from Russia." The vote on passage of the Ukraine funding was 311 to 112. Significantly, 112 Republicans opposed the legislation, with only 101 in support. Mike Johnson is a lame duck. He's done, far-right Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene told reporters afterward. She has been a leading opponent of helping Ukraine in its war against Russia and has taken steps that threaten to remove Johnson from office over this issue. Greene stopped short of doing so on Saturday, however. During the vote, several lawmakers waved small Ukrainian flags as it became clear that element of the package was headed to passage. Johnson warned lawmakers that was a violation of decorum. Meanwhile, the House's actions during a rare Saturday session put on display some cracks in what generally is solid support for Israel within Congress. Recent months have seen progressive Democrats express anger with Israel's government and its conduct of the war in Gaza. Saturday's vote, in which the Israel aid was passed 366 to 58, had 37 Democrats and 21 Republicans in opposition. Passage of the long-awaited legislation was closely watched by U.S. defense contractors, who could be in line for huge contracts to supply equipment for Ukraine and other U.S. partners. Johnson this week chose to ignore ouster threats by hardline members of his fractious 218 to 213 majority and push forward the measure that includes Ukraine funding as it struggles to fight off a two-year Russian invasion. The unusual four-bill package also includes a measure that includes a threat to ban the Chinese-owned social media app TikTok and the potential transfer of seized Russian assets to Ukraine. Some hardline Republicans voicing strong opposition to further Ukraine aid argue the United States can ill afford it given its rising $34 trillion national debt. They have repeatedly raised the threat of ousting Johnson, who became Speaker in October after his predecessor, Kevin McCarthy, was ousted by party hardliners. It's not the perfect legislation. It's not the legislation that we would write if Republicans were in charge of both the House, the Senate, and the White House, Johnson told reporters on Friday. This is the best possible product that we can get under these circumstances to take care of these really important obligations. Representative Bob Good, chair of the hardline House Freedom Caucus, told reporters on Friday that the bills represent a slide down into the abyss of greater fiscal crisis and America Last policies that reflect Biden and Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries and don't reflect the American people. But Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump, who carries huge influence in the party, on April 12th voiced support for Johnson, and in a Thursday social media post said Ukraine's survival is important for the U.S. And that article was entitled House Passes Foreign Aid Package by Richard Cowan, Moira Warburton, and Patricia Zengerle. In more national news, this next article is entitled UAW Sets Its Sights on Mercedes in Alabama. This is by Nora Eckert. The United Auto Workers has made history by winning its first unionization vote at an auto factory in the U.S. South. Now it needs to prove the success wasn't a fluke by pulling off a second victory at a Mercedes plant in Alabama next month. UAW representatives at the VW plant also will have to show their mettle by negotiating a contract that gives workers what they have fought for: better benefits, improved safety on the job, and a greater work-life balance. The Volkswagen landslide win in Tennessee is expected to provide crucial momentum to UAW President Sean Fain's $40 million campaign to expand the union outside Detroit to the South and West, focusing on 13 non-union auto companies, including Toyota and Tesla. Fain, a scrappy leader who reveled in last year's fight with Detroit companies that won double-digit raises and cost-of-living adjustments, told a party of VW workers that the union would carry the fight on to Mercedes. "Let's win more for the working class all over this nation," he said. The Mercedes plant vote, scheduled for mid-May, is expected to be a tougher fight than at VW, which took a neutral position in the vote. Mercedes has said it respects workers' right to organize and wants them to make an informed decision. But in a letter to employees in January, it said that the union organizers cannot guarantee you anything and that some workers had said no to unionization because of Mercedes' competitive pay and benefits. Mercedes is running a much more aggressive anti-union campaign than Volkswagen within the plant, said John Logan, labor professor at San Francisco State University. But he added that the large VW victory that saw 73% of eligible workers vote in favor will provide significant momentum for organizing efforts at other plants in the South. "This will give them a huge boost for the Mercedes vote. And if they win that one too, I wouldn't be surprised to see elections at Hyundai, Honda, and Toyota over the next several months," he said. The UAW says a supermajority of the roughly 5,200 eligible workers at the Mercedes assembly plant in Vance, Alabama, and a nearby battery plant in Woodstock support it. UAW policy is to push for a vote once 70% of workers have signed union cards. Much may depend on economics and perceptions about job security. In the traditionally anti-union South, where the UAW has lost several fights in the past, six Republican governors have flatly opposed the union's current campaign, describing it as risking job security since automakers face higher labor costs. Prior to last autumn's UAW labor talks with the Detroit Three automakers, Ford officials said their U.S. labor costs were $64 an hour, compared with an estimated $55 for foreign automakers and $45 to $50 for electric vehicle leader Tesla. Workers at two other plants, one in the South, a Hyundai plant in Alabama, the other in the Midwest, a Toyota parts factory in Missouri, have also launched organizing campaigns, with 30% of employees signing cards saying they support the UAW. Workers at the VW plant say they will kick off meetings on Sunday to strategize on contract negotiations. The real fight is getting your fair share, Fain told VW workers Friday night. VW worker Jeremy Bowman, who hopes to be on the plant's organizing committee, agreed. The fight is just starting, he said. And that article was entitled UAW Sets Its Sights on Mercedes in Alabama by Nora Eckert. In more world news, this article is entitled Sunak Hurts Britain on Climate Change, Says Watchdog Leader. This is by Elizabeth Piper. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has set Britain back on tackling climate change and must do more on heating and industrial emissions to stop slipping behind other nations, the head of the government's advisory body has said. Chris Stark, who will step down as chief executive of the Independent Climate Change Committee this week, told the BBC broadcaster that UK climate policy had become less ambitious. That is extremely hard to recover, Stark said, according to excerpts from the interview due to air on Sunday. I think it set us back. Under pressure to address cost of living concerns and trailing the opposition Labour Party before an election later this year, Sunak has outraged environmental campaigners by watering down some measures to reach net zero emissions. He said delaying targets for changing cars and domestic heating are pragmatic moves needed to maintain the consent of the British people, with the country's commitment to reach net zero by 2050 still intact. Stark, who has run the committee since April 2018, but will now join consultancy The Carbon Trust as chief executive later this year, said Britain needed to do more work on how homes were heated and industrial emissions managed, as well as in the farming and transport systems. I definitely feel we're at risk, he said. And that is all the time that we have for in this first hour of the Arizona Republic. That article was entitled, Sunak Hurts Britain on Climate Change, Says Watchdog Leader. That was by Elizabeth Piper. This concludes the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, April 21st, 2024. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.